Welcome back to the Discovering Forestry podcast. I'm one of your hosts, Corey Lofi, joined by our friend, Mr. Arborjet Joe Akin, here for another compelling conversation about trees. Joe, it's still pothole season. I know we talked about it last time, but I actually hit one so hard that I apologized to my truck today.
It's amazing. Well, snow better here in Michigan. But you know what's interesting is that the frost laws are on. I am actually surprised at how well our roads did, because we really didn't have a lot of snow through the winter. We just started getting it in March. So we're doing good here, but I think the trees are 2 or 3 weeks behind. Nothing's happening. Even the maples aren't swelling up yet. So I like that because it gives me a time to get caught up. You know, first quarter's over, trade show season, presentations are done. Now we get to get out in the field and do what we do and what we love best. So not bad here. It almost hit 50 today.
50's balmy. I was up in Seattle and Portland last week, and the maples are just starting to bust a groove. A lot of the pears and some of the plums, some of the cherries are starting to flower and push, but the maples were just kind of in that red, you know, getting ready to go. So they want it up there. It's coming.
Yeah, it's coming. It is coming. You know, every year it's the same thing. Oh, it was earlier last year, and Mother Nature will wake up when she wants to wake up. So just be patient, listeners. It's coming.
Well, speaking of being patient, we have got probably one of the highest in-demand arborists in the world, dare I say it, as our guest on the podcast tonight. I've been so fanboy excited over it. I can't even keep it together, Joe.
It's I can understand the excitement. I've known our guest for a while. And once you meet him, then you realize what a great down-to-earth arborist he really is. So I think our listeners would rather bring him on. So I'm going to introduce our guest tonight, Mr. Mark Chisholm. Mark, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, guys. How are you? That's quite a lead up there. Yeah, I don't know if I can live up to all of that, or I agree with it, but I'm happy to be here nonetheless, and looking forward to chatting with you guys today.
Awesome. Thank you. Yeah, we've been trying, like I said, Corey said, we've been trying to get you on for a while. And I know we, in today's IT world, a little hiccup on the last couple times or last time, but no, it's pretty exciting. I know you're on the road. It's got to feel good for you yourself, being in demand, to finally be in sitting home and relaxing. And same with you. Does your show presentation season kind of die out around now too?
Yeah, I think it's pretty much consistent with everybody, more or less. I feel early in the year, it's a hot time. And then, of course, end of year, like, say, October through end of November, not so much goes on in December, I find most years. But, yeah, it does ramp up. But I think there's other stuff that goes on from this point on. It shifts gears for me, in that we tend to do some more, like, all-day workshops, hands-on stuff in different parts of the world that we don't do when the weather's not good, because we're outdoors now.
So more like tailgate safety, field stuff, rigging, climbing, all the fun stuff. So workshops.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Climbing, aerial rescue, rigging, you name it. We do a lot of crane stuff nowadays. A lot of people have a need and a desire to kind of hone their skills in crane work. So we tend to do some hands-on workshops on crane use pretty much every year consistently, just different parts of the world pretty much.
That crane mechanized arboriculture has come up a few times on the podcast, on the way the industry is trending. You know, I think we laughed one time when I asked a guy to grab a ball cart, and a guy, he had no idea what a ball cart was. You know, when I started, that's how you move logs in the backyard. But it is trending. So I could see, and obviously safety is, you know, key number one. I could see the mechanized change. And like I said, you've been in the business a long time, Mark. You've had to see the change.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And honestly, when I first started doing, just talking about even just crane work alone, not much less everything else, but just crane work alone, when I started doing it, there was no courses, there was no manuals, there was no training that I was aware of. And so we learned by just from other mentors passing knowledge on and giving your best to try to pick it up as you go. But I don't think that's really the best way to learn per se. I think what we're doing now is way better, and it's better for the end user, like a climber like myself. If I had a course I could take that was hands-on, that would show me the ins and outs and teach me how to make good decisions, and understand the science behind how a crane even works, I would have been like brought up to speed a lot quicker. So I definitely appreciate that people put these on. And I think I stuck my neck out early on in my career doing these because nobody wanted to show crane work, because it was kind of like taboo, in a sense that we're not supposed to tie into a crane. And back then it was even worse. You know, it was almost like, you know, don't show anybody what you're doing, because they're going to want to come and, you know, create regulation around it. And the regulations were already there. It just, nobody was showing them, hey, we really need this as an option to stay safe.
You think part of it, I know the regulatory side, but I remember, you know, back in the day, we would set a 20, 30 foot ladder. Now that's even taboo. People look at you kind of different if you want to use a ladder on a tree job. You know, even back then, you know, to find a guy, hey, is that crane company? Has he ever done tree work before? No, but he's pretty good on a crane. So yeah, it has changed a lot. And I don't think anybody puts ladders on the truck anymore either.
Yeah, they don't even put ladder racks on the chip trucks anymore. They used to be on every chip truck when I was growing up. My brother,
they all got
still
ripped off. They all got ripped off on the curb because the branches were too low and their ladder ended up on the chipper.
Yeah, yeah, for good sure. Time.
Well, so Mark, how long have you been in the industry and climbing? I know part of what you do is work for Aspen or with Aspen, but can you tell the listeners a little bit about just how involved you've been, what you've done to get to where you are?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no way around just saying I've been in it a long time, and I'm, I probably been in the industry longer than some people have their career in any field. Like, most people retire by the time this year hits, as far as how many years I've been doing. I mean, you know, granted, I officially started climbing when I was about 13, 12, started in the field, but, you know, I was still in high school, so I didn't really officially do it for a career path until I got out of high school. But, you know, it's been a very long time. I mean, I started when I'm 12, I'm 52 now. That's a long time doing tree climbing, no matter what level you're doing it at.
Wow. Yeah. Your body feels it. Now you started, this was a family business. You got into it because it was a family.
Yeah.
So were your father, grandfather, how far back does it go?
Yeah. So I'm a third generation arborist. But our family business was started by my father. My grandfather wasn't a part of that. He got out of the tree business when he started my dad doing it, and got into trucking and was a truck driver for a long time. My dad liked it, got into it, stayed with it. And then it just kind of trickled down from there. My brother started before I was old enough, because he's 2 years older than me. And I just remember seeing them come in and how they treated my brother with respect, that, you know, because he was like, at the time he was like 13 or 14, and they were talking about how he was, you know, starting to work like well and keeping up with the guys that have been doing it for a long time, working the ground like a real professional arborist. And, you know, hearing their stories on a Saturday when, obviously, when you have a family business, especially tree care, I find the early days, your employees tend to be your family members or best friends, right? And that's kind of where ours started. And so I'd hear my father, my brother, my uncle, my godfather, friends come in, and they're goofing with each other, loved being around each other, and talked about their war stories from the day and how they survived everything and succeeded, and, you know, things that went wrong. And it just seemed like such a cool thing to be a part of. I think that's my earliest memory of saying, I'd like to do this.
That's cool. I remember I got into it. I'm 57, and I think I was about 13 or 14 the first time I swung a chainsaw around. So we've been doing about the same.
Yeah.
Mine started more of a, I didn't know that it was an industry, because this was on a family farm. I just, hey, go cut that down on the hedgerow. I'm like, oh, okay. And there was no training. It was like 20 years after that, I realized after I got in the Marine Corps that this is an industry. Like, really?
Yeah.
So, but I've been around it for a long time, and it's been exciting. And I still love it. I think Corey and I banter back and forth about I may not be working for corporate arboriculture after 65, but I'll always be in the tree business at some facet doing something with trees.
Yeah, I can understand that. I think a lot of us feel the same way at this stage in the game. I got a lot of friends that have businesses too, and they're always asking like, "Hey, what's retirement? When are you retiring? And when are you gonna do this? When are you gonna do that?" And I just tell them like, you know, for me personally, I feel like retirement is a very personal thing. It's not like a cookie cutter thing for everybody. Retirement doesn't mean you just say I'm done at 25 or 30 years or whatever, and then just walk away. Sometimes I think retirement, you know, watching my father still being part of our business, just doing it differently than he did years ago. I feel like retirement is what you make out of it. You know, for someone like my father, it just might mean he doesn't do any of the stuff he doesn't want to do. He doesn't do the day-to-day scheduling, sales, blah, blah, blah. He does what he feels like doing when he wants to do it and always helps the business out when he does. And I feel like that could be, you know, a form of retirement all to itself. And maybe he's fully retired and doesn't know it.
Oh, and awesome. The fact that he comes to the shop every day and loves it, you know, you can't beat that.
Yep. And I think people like that. I mean, I grew up in that whole kind of mentality of like work was pretty much everything, and that's what you focus on. That's what you dig into, and you do it for the right reasons. And, you know, before you know it, in the blink of an eye, we're talking about retirement. But I think people like that don't necessarily fit into that retirement bubble of, hey, you know, like the 25, 30 and out, like some other industries, I should say, not most, but, you know, from what I hear about a lot of people, I think it might even be detriment to our own health. You know, I hear from like farmers, you mentioned being up on a farm. I remember an old farmer telling me, your dad's still doing it. And this is like 15 years ago. And I said, yeah, you can't stop him. He says, good. He's like, tell him, don't ever quit. He says, he's a worker like me. He says, if he stops working, he won't have a reason to get up. And then before you know it, he'll be underground, not above ground.
Yeah. Great advice. Now, Mark, as your career, and I understand how and why you became an industry spokesman. If we look back on some of the hardware that you've won in climbing comps. Now, you started climbing comps back when they kind of were really getting professional and serious. And it's a pretty cool stat. Let the listeners know on how many times you won New Jersey.
Yeah.
Where that took you and some of the amazing things you got to do internationally.
Well, yeah. I honestly, when people talk about competing, I would say apart from growing up in the family business and the people I was surrounded with, the very best thing that I think was putting me in the proper place I need to become like passionate about tree care was the competition. If I singled out one thing, because you know, the short answer is it instilled so much in me to want to learn the very best practices, learn the safest techniques, and become as proficient as anyone in the world because I was competing against them and always wanting to improve because I knew if I didn't improve next year, I definitely didn't have a shot at winning because everyone else was obviously improving around me. So I started my first competitions in New Jersey at the chapter level. And it was probably, I think I was 18 or 19. I might've been 19. I might've skipped my first year. They had to convince me to compete because I didn't see the value at first, my friends and mentors. Eventually they talked me into it. I did compete and I didn't do well, and it made me want to do better even so. So it made me want to come back. And that's when it first started. The passion kind of hit me as far as the competitions goes, because I wanted to do better than I did the year prior. And then it stemmed from there. And so I didn't win my first year. I took fifth, which was good, but I had some real embarrassing moments in that fifth place running. So they encouraged me. They said, I did great, had good skill, come on back. So I did. And sec to the guy who won the year prior, which was a really big compliment because he was a fantastic climber, still is actually. I saw him last month. His name was Glenn Dujets, by the way. And Glenn won 3 years in a row. I took second the next 2 years, but something happened that third year I competed. And I, back then they would let two people from every chapter compete at the international level. You just had to pay your own way as a second place guy, which I didn't mind doing because I was, you know, I was working my way up. And my first international was in Philadelphia. The second year I competed, I made it to the internationals and I did horribly there. I timed out an aerial rescue amongst other things. I didn't, you know, in hindsight, I did horrible for me because I made stupid mistakes, but overall, you know, I was definitely in the bottom three quarters of the group. I was probably, I want to say I was probably around 28th place out of 32 or four people, somewhere in that range. So I didn't do too good, which made me want to improve. So that's really where it all came down to, like the whole wanting to improve. But the third year we went out to California and I ended up going from like 28th in the world to third in the world. And that's really when I realized, you know, if I keep watching people around me, learning, listening from what they're telling me and trying to improve it in my own time, you know, I could do good and come back and see these again next year. And it became about, it really didn't become about winning so much as it became about, I want to see these people and learn some more and be part of this again. And that's where it stemmed. But to answer your first question, it made me want to come back year after year for so long that I ended up winning New Jersey for 21 years. And I went to the internationals 24 times, I think, or 23 times. That's a good question now. 23 times I went to the internationals, I believe.
Jeez. No, that's amazing. And you actually won three times, I think. Is that correct? Three internationals?
Yeah. Yeah. I was the biggest loser by far than anyone before me because no one's competed more than that and lost most of them. But you know what? I laugh about it because obviously I didn't lose anything. But I won three times. I can't tell you how many times I took second. I was known for being consistent because I took it so seriously. And I definitely wasn't like kind of someone who was evolving every year, watching, learning, trying to improve. So I became consistent in that. I think 23 years of competing, I was top 10 21 times, and I think top 5 19 of those 21 times. So I made top 5 for 19 years, which obviously speaks to the level at which I wanted to be there. It's passion that kept me wanting to improve and get better each year.
No, that's phenomenal. Thanks for sharing that with us. I know a lot of people – I know that's out there. People can find it if they wanted to, but hearing it from you is actually pretty special. I want to take a different direction. Now, Corey and I started this podcast to raise the bar, and it was during the pandemic. We're like, well, we got to do something. We got to reach people. I'm not sure if enough of the industry understands that you're kind of a pioneer on outreach and industry spokesperson because you started – something, I'm not sure how long it's been going, but you started Tree Buzz way in the back when there really wasn't any forum for this industry to reach out and chat and educate each other. Let the listeners know a little bit of history on Tree Buzz and how long you've been doing that.
Yeah, I mean, Tree Buzz started Tree Buzz in, I mean, officially, I started before it went live, right? I started it and probably it went live and I registered in 2000 and it went live in 2001. And that whole deal really was, it was really a spinoff from the competition, if I can explain it any easier. Honestly, it was me sitting around when the internet started coming around and I said, how can we do what we do at the competitions and TCI expos where we all get together and meet and exchange ideas. How can we do that like every day or every week or whenever we feel like it rather than waiting for a year to go by till we see each other again and try to speed up this process of learning and growing as a group. And I think when the internet first came around, I'm like, I don't know how to do this yet. But then I realized it was the birth of forums before social media. And I still think there's a difference between them all. And I find there's more value for me in the educational aspect with the forum and the website rather than social media. Social media gives you like bits and pieces and what have you. But if I went out to you and I said, hey, we're going to discuss a new insect problem, whatever it is, let's just say emerald ash borer when it became a big topic, we can actually go back and forth and have a thread, a topic where people can follow it like it's a chapter in a book and the book gets written. And there's no trying to figure out where it went or any interruptions where people start talking about climbing in the middle of it or whatever. It's kind of unique and as in different in social media in that respect, that we can stay on a topic. We can search it like it's a chapter in a book anytime we want. It's there forever.
Yeah, it's pretty amazing. So thank you for that. And I think, like I said, it's another part of your legacy. I guess, I don't know. Can you say legacy yet or should I hold off?
No, I don't really think about it like that. I mean, I don't even know what that would be like for me, what a legacy would be. But I definitely, I feel like that I do with any significance or importance is just basically following the leads of people I've looked up to in different ways. They tell you how to spend time, you know, freely giving information, teaching, and showing up and being part of things.
No, thanks for that. And yeah, thanks for continuing to maintain. Like I said, you're busy, you know, you're busy and then still have the time to continue. That is amazing. You got some amazing, it was funny that, I got to see you and John Ball at MGIA in Michigan. And I was going to bring in an antique chainsaw and you're like, nope, can't be around that one.
So, yeah.
But, steel, being a spokesperson for steel is amazing. It's brought you to some pretty cool opportunities. Not to be confused with the Steel Timber Sports Series, but have they invited you to go to some of those? Or is it?
We talked about it. We talked about it many times. But you know, it's almost like one of those things, like you can only say yes to so many things. You know, you travel a bunch too. It's like, you can't always take on a whole new part of a career per se, or follow the series and like become passionate about something else. So we never really went down that path. I probably could have pushed it, or they could have pushed me, and I would have said yes, because if it made sense, it made sense. But we tend to, I mean, I should probably first say just like how grateful I am to have the relationship with Steel and now Teufelberger and Cask as well, because to your point, you do so much more. You get so much opportunity to do hit your goals if you have collaboration. And I look at my partnership with Steel, which has gone on since 2001, believe it or not. We've been partners for that long, and it's because we have the same values, same goals, same mindset, and we operate in a very similar way. We care mostly about sharing information, sharing safety, helping the community, doing things like that, because it's the right thing to do, and it has nothing to do with dollar signs per se. You know, it's more about what makes us tick. Me as a person, the people of Steel, they all agree with me. Like, this is what we all are passionate about. And, so that's why we partner. That's why we're still partnering. It's been successful for that long, because we both value that relationship so much, because we know what it does for us and for an industry as well. And to your point, has it done things for me that were special? Absolutely. I've met some amazing people. I'm talking everyday people. I'm also talking people that you would know because they're in the spotlight somewhere, you know, singers. You and I talked about Coach Babcock from the Red Wings. I met him through Steel. He's a big Steel fanatic as well. And, you know, next thing I know, I'm on the bench with the Red Wings hanging out at a practice because of my Steel affiliation. So I could go on and talk a whole nother episode about what Steel has meant to me and what opportunities have come because of that relationship.
Oh, I think that's amazing. Corey was so excited to have you on. So I'm going to let Corey ask you a few questions. Go ahead, Corey.
Well, we might only have time for one or two more before I just start thanking you profusely. but as you're looking at your career and at the impact you're making, you know, and you're a humble guy and a super knowledgeable guy, but as you're looking at all of this, is there anything else that you want to accomplish in your career in the field of arboriculture while you still have while you still have the time?
Yeah, I mean, specifically, I check boxes every time someone asks me, do you want to do X or do you want to do Y? I look at it from kind of like two lenses. Who are we going to be dealing with? Is it everyday property owners and people that are non-tree related or non-professional groups? And then, or is it the professional group? So if it's the non-professional group, I'm looking to say, all right, how can I get a message to them that trees are fantastic, they're valuable, they need care, and you need to hire a professional to care for them the right way. And how to find a professional, for example. Those are boxes I'd like to check. If we can do that, I say yes, we do it. On the professional side, I don't have to say those messages to them. So my message to the pro side is what I feel really passionate about is, can I help you become safer? Can I help you become better, more professional, more effective? Or can I just make you enjoy what you do more and feel pride and be happy about being an arborist and make you want to go back to work on Monday just a little more excited to do so? And those are boxes I try to check. And so it's a simplistic approach. It's nothing specific, if that's the direction you were going, like what specifically, but those are things I still try to do to this day, and I don't want to stop doing those.
Oh, that's awesome. Because we do have a lot of listeners, and Joe and I do interact with both people on the professional, on the B2B side, but also, at the municipal level and sometimes even the homeowner level. Mark, as we're wrapping this up, and really just trying to draw this conversation to a close, if you could get a message out to some of those professionals or those aspiring professionals, just what basic advice would you give them?
Everybody always talks safety as job one. I don't take that lightly. Obviously, that's why I put so much effort into hopping on planes and going to workshops and teaching and sharing information. It's really because I can't stand seeing and hearing people getting hurt doing what I love to do. And I never feel like I risk my life being an arborist my whole career. There's risks, but I really feel if you have the right training and the right mentorship, really on the local front, you can do it like me your whole career and never have a near-death experience. I mean, I still play hockey to this day at my age, and I have all my parts work. I still climb to this day. If you follow me on Instagram or whatever, you'll see that. Like, I'm not faking it. I really feel that that's the real message to send. So, I would say get training. Don't ever stop training. Always be a student, because that's what suits me and I see it work in my life, and I hope it's the right message for other people. And I would also say, remember that how professional you act influences how people treat arborists like myself, even if you're in a different part of the world. So we always got to try to remember, like, to act appropriate, to shine the best light we can on the industry, because we don't always get that from the media. And it's always bothered me since I was a teenager, is that I know how skilled we are. I know how what a quality group does tree care for a living. And we don't always get that kind of nod from society or from the public. And I think that's the wrong message. And I think it's our duty to just show them that what we really are about. And I think that's what I would push other people to try to do with me.
Perfect. Perfect, Mark. Well, we are going to wrap up. I personally can't thank you enough for finally getting a chance to, all of us connect, the stars aligned. We got you on, and I look forward to seeing you whenever you're at any event, and keep up the great work. And if there's anything we at Discovering Forestry could ever do to help you and your endeavors, please reach out, and we'll do whatever we can to help spread the word, and help
Yeah.
you also.
Well, I appreciate that, Joe and Corey. And I would say you can do one thing is just invite me back again sometime so we can chat again in the near future, because this is fun and it's always a good time. And I appreciate the opportunity for that.
Awesome, Mark. Thank you so much. Have a great rest of your day. Have a safe week. And yeah, we'll be talking to you soon.
All right. Cheers, guys. Take care.
Hey, great topic today.
Yes, and lots of good information.
Yeah, probably one of our best yet.
If you enjoyed the podcast or have topics you would like to discuss, please send them to discoveringforestry@gmail.com. and please hit the subscribe button and tell a friend.
Thanks, guys, for tuning in. Until next time, I'm Joe.
And I'm Corey.
Signing out.